Well, tonight we're talking about Aliens in America, a UFO Hunter's Guide to Extraterrestrial Hotspots Across the United States with William J. Burns. We call him Bill Burns. We'll be back in a moment with Bill on Coast to Coast Day Out. All right, welcome back to Coast. William Burns, Bill Burns, New York Times best-selling author, a magazine publisher, a New York literary publishing agent as well. You've seen him on the History Channel's UFO Hunters. And, of course, he is the publisher of UFO Magazine, and it's been my pleasure to have him as our partner in two books, Worker in the Light, Journey to the Light, and more coming up down the pike. Hey, Bill, how are you?
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good. Most of the time I talk to you, it's during the daytime. I haven't had a chance to talk with you in the wee hours in a long, long time.
This is true. The sun's usually up. I'm like, stunned.
I remember back in 1997 when I first got you on, when we talked about the day after Roswell, and then you became almost a regular guest on the local KTRS station. Remember those days?
I sure do. What I used to do is, I mean, you were in St. Louis and I was in Los Angeles, and in those days where we lived in Venice, California, since I knew that I'd be on the show that night, I would have a corded phone. I set up a special phone by the couch, take a nap on the couch, get up a half hour, make coffee, sit on the couch, do the call.
I remember when we kept talking and talking, and that was what gave me the idea that whenever I wanted to do my own books, that you'd be the ideal partner. And that worked out great for us, Bill.
It did. I mean, right now where we are, and we have two books in, three books in process. It's funny. Ironically, you're mentioning the two books, Worker in the Light and Journey to the Light. And what was so funny was this past weekend, I had a chance to talk to the folks at the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the Edgar Cayce Group.
Mm-hmm. Good people.
They are. I mean, when you realize the amount of information they have, it's kind of like they have their own Akashic records in that building in Virginia Beach. But here's the ironic thing. It's so funny. Because I was there one night. Stan Friedman was there the previous night, supposedly talking about UFOs. And Stan always can talk about UFOs. And he's probably, you know, I would say far and away the single best person to talk about the evidence for UFOs and the science behind flying saucers. Absolutely the best. There is no equal to Stan. He's the gold standard. And so Stan does. And then on the next night, we were going to talk about, again, flying saucers. And Stan covered the whole subject. So when they began talking and asking questions, I began talking about Edgar Cayce, and we segued into Worker in the Light and Journey to the Light. And the reason was, and this is why those books were so exciting for me to write, because in Worker and in Journey, and we can talk about your own experience, your own out-of-body experience, because that actually came up in the conversation, believe it or not. And in talking about it, it was how what Edgar Cayce did, his role in American history and his role kind of not denying his own intuitive abilities. People deny their own intuitive abilities all the time, and that's what Worker in the Light is all about. And that's what was so thrilling about writing that book with you, is starting from your own experience of that out-of-body experience and with, you know, your relative Shafika, talking about her experiences, and from there going into how anyone, you don't have to be gifted with a sixth sense. You don't have to have special powers. You're not divine. There's nothing superhuman about you. You can train yourself to be an intuitive to some degree. And that was, and that's what we wound up talking about, believe it or not, at the Edgar Cayce Conference.
And you know, we've practiced this personally, Bill, for
so many years
now, getting better and better and better doing it. But I had fun writing these two books with you. I'm having fun writing the other three. The next one that we're doing is Nero Blaze, the time traveler. I shouldn't say too much about him.
Right.
That's a pet project, as you know.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a book that we really, I mean, there are so many great aspects to it, but The fun part about Nero, and I'll just say this without really going into plot, because, I mean, the plot is unique. It is that Nero is although it's ostensibly science fiction, it's based on what some people say is fact, that there are places on this planet that literally are time portals. And one could, and you and I heard the story together, by the way, right on Coast to Coast when we interviewed Paul Smith. People can actually get trapped in time. People can go through time. We know that Paul Smith talked about it all the way back in the 1980s. People can actually travel in time, but one can get trapped in time. One can lose the tether that one has to his or her experience in a current timeline. And when you start researching this and when you start looking into the ways to get trapped in time and what happens, and I know I'm going too far with the plot, but what happens if you, what happens if you do get trapped in time and have to live through your own time again and again and again? And that's as far as I'm going to go for Nero. But when the time comes, it's going to be a very interesting experience for an actor to portray, if we do get a movie, if somebody picks it up for a motion picture, and I think somebody will, what an actor is going to have to go through, going through various time periods, aging agonizingly slowly.
Absolutely. I know it's going to be fun. Hey, by the way, it's talking about fun. You looked like you had a great time doing the UFO Hunters show.
I did. There were ups and downs. And what's so ironic is that in this issue of UFO Magazine, there's a story about J.D. Salinger as a spy. And that's in this current issue of the magazine. And the person who wrote that story actually crossed our path when we were in season three investigating that whole Brookhaven South Park fire that ostensibly was a shoot down on the John Ford story and how he wound up in a mental institution. And we had interviewed the fire chief at Brookhaven National Labs, Chief Chuck, really sweet guy. And we asked him on camera, Chuck, if something had, now you have all these witnesses who saw the Brookhaven Fire Department trucks at South Haven Park. So this is not some kind of odd legend. They saw the trucks. They were there. So we asked Chuck, and we held the logs in our hand of when these trucks rolled out, and sure enough, there's nothing for that date in November. So we asked Chuck, if somebody told you to erase the logs and not write it down and deny, would you say you don't know, or would you deny it happened? And so Chuck looked at us and looked at, you know, obviously looked into the camera, looked at us, and said, I would flat out deny it. So in other words, he's actually telling you what happened. So we're in Port Jefferson, and this guy, strange guy, really well-heeled, well-dressed guy, is standing off camera, right? And he's looking and looking, and finally, off camera, and I'm standing by the dock, and I'm looking out of Long Island Sound, and he walks over and said, you know that Brookhaven Park was there and that the crash at South Haven Park actually happened. And I'm looking at him. He said, how do you know? He said, let's just say that I work for a group of people out here on Long Island, and I know the truth, and I know what happens at University of Stony Brook, State University of Stony Brook, and I know what happened at South Haven Park, and I would love to talk to you about the Corso book and why your show is not going to be on next year. And we began a long conversation, and sure enough, so I knew, even before we went to the Bahamas for Underwater Area 51, that certain elements within certain agencies were very angry at the show because of what happened at Area 51 the year before, and what happened at Dulce, New Mexico, and which is the Ancient Alien show this Thursday night, and why there was going to be retribution for it. It was really odd and very prophetic. And he wound up becoming friends, and he's now writing for the magazine.
That is amazing. And now you've got this latest work out called Aliens in America. Tell me about this.
Well, what I found out along the road at UFO Hunters is that there's a large group of people out there, a huge number of people. I mean, the numbers are staggering, that would love to know more about UFOs in American history, but quite frankly, don't want to wade through the science and don't want to wade through the debates. And as you know, the field of UFO research is marked by various debates. Mm-hmm. X is hoaxing, Y is hoaxing, this is true, this is not true. And I found out that there was a really large group of readers who just wanted to find out what the news was about what happened and what are the pros, what are the cons, and then move along. And so I went to this one publisher that does, and I figured out if we did it as a travel guide, and the travel guide is if you want to see UFO spots, so it's not this distant, remote past. It's literally, are there events going on? Are there places you could learn about this? Libraries and museums like Roswell, the Roswell Museum, the celebration and the conferences about the Betty and Barney Hill case, the UFO conference for Bucks County, where you can learn about these things. And if you're interested in UFOs and what happens, you can go there. And here's where you can stay. Take your RV, take your camper, go book a hotel room, eat. How do you get there? And that's the book.
That's, you know, and it's kind of neat, the cover in the back. I haven't seen typewriter print like that in 30 years.
Right. And they did it because that was how some of the original the publishers
reports were,
because
yeah.
of the Roswell stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, we used to pound away like that even before we had the electric typewriters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gosh, yeah. Can you imagine how far we've gone with technology, Bill?
Well, you and I are of that generation where you really had to have strength in your fingers to hit those typewriter keys.
I am still a two-finger typist, 50 to 60 words a minute, brutally fast. But I started off when I was 19 years old, working for a television station in Detroit. You know, the anchor guy told me, he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I need this story really fast. Hurry up. I'm on the air in a few minutes." So I started writing it out longhand first before I tried to type, which I couldn't type yet. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing the story. Then I'm going to put it down on." No, he said, No. "You sit next to the typewriter and you type it out as if you were going to write it." And I said, "Well, I've never done that before." And he's just, his eyes are rolling, Bill. And he's on the air in 5 minutes. So he gives the story to somebody else. He says, "Look, I need this now." And he said, "But kid, come over here and watch him. I'm 19 years old, Bill."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching this guy type up this story. He's not writing it out longhand. You know, it's, you know, fire in East Detroit, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And afterwards, he said, "I want you to practice writing stories from the typewriter, not longhand. Now start typing." And I said, "Well, I don't know how to type." And he went, "Who hired you?" And that's another long story. I'd filled in for a friend of mine. And we went to the same college, the University of Detroit. And he went home for Christmas. He went back to Cleveland, and they needed someone to fill in, or they wouldn't let him go. So they brought me in. He recommended me, and they kept me and him when he came back. But I didn't know anything about anything. But I started learning how to type, but I typed like most of the older anchor people did, and that was with your two index fingers. And so you'd, like, just like that, you know, you'd pound away. And that's how I learned, and that's how I am right now. So even when I'm on a keyboard with a computer, I'm a two-finger person.
Okay, now how do you type on your smartphone?
With one finger.
Yeah, just I can't do the thumbs.
Just my right finger. No, I see younger guys and girls with their thumbs going back and forth, and it's brutally fast. But I'm with one little finger. And
the worst part is they've got these long nails, and I don't know how they do it that fast.
Yeah, it is amazing.
While they drive.
Yep, it sure is. Anyways, with this incredible story, Aliens in America, you've got 20 great cases here. How'd you come up with these, and what was your criteria?
Well, there you go. I mean, you could pick hundreds of cases, right? Well, criteria A was it was North America. They didn't. I came up with why I wanted to do Bentwaters, I wanted to do Todd Morton, I wanted to do various cases that I liked, right? And they said, no. It's got to be North America because the people reading this book are going to be going on summer vacations. They want to get to a place in a few hours, not fly across an ocean. Okay, so limit it to North America. That was first of all. The second thing that they said was try to get cases where you can discuss the science of the cases. So it's not just Mary Jo in the middle of Idaho sees a light outside a window and gets abducted. Talk about the evidence. Talk about the proof. Talk about it succinctly, but talk about it in a way that somebody who's not a UFO specialist, who doesn't have a degree in physics, can read the book and read, oh, so-and-so took these pictures, and here are the pictures that the person took, right? Talk about... is there science? And so we developed this thing about the four prongs of various cases, that there are multiple credible witnesses, not just one person in a dark. I mean, those are valid stories. You hear the stories on the air. We wrote about these stories in Worker in the Light and Journey to the Light.
Right.
So, I mean, we took these very seriously. But multiple credible witnesses, physical trace evidence from whatever happened, and is there some kind of government reaction, government documents, like in, something in MJ-12, something about a special letter or something. And then I added a fourth, and my fourth was interesting because I think this is one of the – for me, it's one of the most important things about this. And this is what happened in Gulf Breeze and McMinnville and Rex Heflin cases, the McDonald cases, and it's – What do the powers that be, what does government do to debunk the case, to call people hoaxers, to wreck their lives, to destroy the evidence? What does the government do? Because it's, you know how light bends around a black hole? There's a new black hole the scientists have just discovered way out 50 mm-hmm. million light years away, and they discovered it by the way light is swirling around it. Well, truth, reality swirls around the black hole of the truth that nobody wants you to know about. And so when you see the extent that government goes to deny something, right, like the Phoenix Lights, why does the National Guard have to show up and talk about the 1030 lights right. when people like Fife Symington and Lynn Kitai and folks like that are talking about the 830 lights? Okay, I mean, it just makes no sense. And they come up with a story about flares at the 1030 lights. Then they go ahead and they do a flare experiment 3 years later, which looks nothing like the 830 object that people saw floating across Arizona. That's what I mean. Bentwaters, they come up with a whole bunch of explanations that make absolutely no sense. Roswell crash dummies. Why would the government do that?
And after great eyewitness testimony.
Yes, that's the whole point. So why would the government do more of a hoax than the hoax they're saying the people did in the first place? And that's the fourth prong of these cases. So that was how I chose the cases.
Well, what I'd like to do when we come back after the break is talk about your very first case, which is one of my favorites, the Betty and Barney Hill case. And as you know, when I was a young puppy reporter, I interviewed their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon. You illustrated that in UFO Magazine and the editorial that I do for you every month. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our special guest, Bill Burns. His latest work, Aliens in America, his website, UFOMag.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Bill Burns. Bill, one of your first stories, first chapters, has to do with the Betty and Barney Hill case, the New Hampshire couple abducted. It was probably the first case that truly was brought to the forefront. Look Magazine pushed it. John Fuller's book, Interrupted Journey, pushed it. And I see you've got it in there.
Right, because that was the case, as you say, and it's so ironic that you had that you did the interview with Benjamin Simon about it. But what's so fascinating is here is a case that over the years, as more and more people look at the case critically, more and more layers were pulled back from the case so that the nexus, the core of the case, remains as one of the most stunning cases of human contact with some kind of otherworldly beings. And even though Benjamin Simon himself, I mean, basically, the reason I chose the case was because of its importance in American history. It was a cover story on Look magazine, it was a movie of the week, right? James Earl Jones bought the movie after he read the Look magazine article and bought the fuller book, Interrupted Journey. Stan Friedman and Kathy Martin, Kathy, of course, was Betty's niece. They wrote a book, Captured, about the Betty and Barney Hill case. And it was a case we did in the first season on UFO hunters. We really pushed for it in Alien Contact. And the reason was that so many people misunderstood the case. They thought that the Hills remembered nothing, that everything that they remembered about the journey that was interrupted came out of the hypnotic regression sessions with Benjamin Simon. And, of course, none of that is true. Betty and Barney had conscious memories of seeing the craft being followed by this light in the sky. Barney actually stops the car, looks over this mountain to see the light come towards them. Betty and Barney get very, very frightened. What is this thing in the sky? Why is it following us? The thing actually is over their car. Then when they think they've escaped it, they're on this lonely road, Exeter, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. This object actually stops in the road in front of them. They see these small creatures. And Betty called her sister the next morning after the event to tell her exactly what happened. Where their memories stop is after Barney goes to get his gun, because he's carrying a gun in the car. And he goes to get his gun, and these creatures just yank him out of the car. Betty flees. She's trying to run for the woods. The creatures grab her, and they grab her, and they drag her to a clearing. And that's where their memories stop. And their memories pick up again while they're driving right up to their driveway where they live. And they realize when they see the clocks that they can't account for a number of hours. And that's where their own personal investigation begins into the story. And the reason I chose this was, A, it's an important piece of American history. B, it's a case that most people casually don't understand. They think, oh, they were trying to hide this thing. No, they went to Pease Air Force Base. They reported it to the Air Force. There was a whole range of activities that Betty and Barney did to try and investigate their own what happened to them. And then they didn't just go running to a regression therapist. They actually, Barney had physical reactions. Obviously, he had, as now we all know, he had these bumps coming up, these warts around his genital area. He was very sensitive about that. Something was wrong with him physically. And Betty Hill had these strange stains within 24 hours on her dress, where the dress she was wearing that night. So there's physical trace evidence of what happened, and there's medical records of Barney. So they go to doctors. They try to figure out what's wrong. Barney is having post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, now we know what that was. And he is having physiological reactions to what happened to him that he can't remember. And it's very invasive, and it has to do literally with what we would call it now would be sex abuse. I mean, he was abused aboard that spacecraft. Finally, his medical doctor, his family doctor says, you know what, there's nothing wrong with you, Barney. Let me recommend you to a psychiatrist. They recommend him to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist hears the story of the missing time and realizes there's only one person in this country, this very famous psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was well known from World War II because he was the doctor that pilots and people who had PTSD events, triggering events, went to confront the trauma. And that's where the story begins.
And what he told me, Bill, was, George, I can't tell you whether their story is true or not. But I can tell you, whatever they think they saw, they saw in their minds. They believe this story. And that was a dramatic statement all by itself, Bill.
Yes. And I mean, you're the one that taught, and this was years ago when you told me this.
Yep.
And what's so fascinating is when you go back through the records, again, Benjamin Simon had no mechanism in his practice. And if you look at the basic book for psychiatrists and psychologists today on the Diagnostic Symptoms Manual, how to look for various symptoms, and it's funny because it's gone through, I think, five incarnations, and now the latest one are all the codes for billing, right? So, I mean, it's how to bill for post-traumatic stress disorder, for obsessive compulsion disorder, right? There's nothing on alien abduction. Nothing. Not a thing. So how could Benjamin Simon treat Betty and Barney Hill for alien abduction, and there's no such thing as alien abduction in all the medical texts that he's going to refer to? It's an unknown syndrome. So he begins to look, so he doesn't believe that there are such things as aliens, but he has these two patients that he's working with who fundamentally believe this is what happens. And look at how he did this. He interviews them and regresses them separately so that there's no cross-contamination between their stories. That's first of all. In other words, he does what police do. They split the witnesses up to get their respective stories. Then he tells them not to remember what they're telling him so the events of their daily life don't intrude on, let's call it for argument's sake, the purity of their respective stories. They remain uncontaminated by their own judgment of their stories. And he's trying to work with them on that.
Tell us about, and we'll move on to a different case in a second, Bill, but tell us about Betty's description of the star cluster where the apparent ETs told her they came from, which was then highlighted in a star map later on.
Yes. Now, this is where it gets fascinating, because for all the people that say, and a lot of people have said, oh, come on, Betty was having dreams, Barney was having dreams, the two of them influenced each other, they were tired on the road, they had a hallucination, and remember, the big event that happened right about the same time of the abduction was the premiere of Outer Limits. And Outer Limits had this creature, this big creature. And in fact, for the Star Trek book that I wrote with Alan Sims and Mike Westmore years and years ago, I interviewed the person who created that alien head for Outer Limits. His name is Wa-Ming Chang, and he was the original props designer for Star Trek, the original series. Mm-hmm. And he told us how he invented the big-headed alien. It's the same one he used for Baylock and in a later Star Trek series, Gorn the Reptile. And so he was telling us about this. And you put the two and two together, yeah, Barney Hill saw the Outer Limits thing, but that's not what happened, because Barney didn't see the Outer Limits, and he and Betty never discussed the dreams he was having. And then there's this two pieces of stunning evidence that nobody can explain. One is that under hypnosis, Betty Hill said that this kind of the chief, you know, like the supervisor, I don't know what you would call him, but like the medical director, because they were doing medical tests on Betty.
Right.
This medical director, she actually asked, she was very sentient, she was very sapient aboard this craft. She wasn't some passive victim. She actually asked, where are you from? And so apparently they were very forthcoming in their explanation, and they showed her a map of a twin star, which we now know is Eta Reticuli, but it was this twin star, and they showed her the planet in the system of that twin star, which is, what, only 8 light years away. So it's like, you know, it's going from Amsterdam Avenue, the top of Central Park, Cathedral Parkway in New York City, down to Little Italy. I mean, that's literally what it is. And that's how close it is. And so Betty Hill, under hypnosis, drew the map from memory that this supervising entity aboard the craft showed her. Well, of course, at the time she drew the map, nobody knew that existed. And they said, well, it's, you know, no twin stars. It couldn't be. This is a fake. This shows the whole thing is a fake. It's a hallucination, et cetera, et cetera. Well, years later, the Gliese catalog, the exact star system was discovered. And then shortly after that, the exoplanets in that star system were discovered, and they were discovered in exactly the same places. So the Gliese star chart and the location of the planet matched the map that Betty Hill drew from memory that the person on board that spacecraft showed her.
That's amazing. You know, I've been talking with Richard Hoagland and others about disclosure. I still say, Bill, I don't think it's coming. What do you think?
I completely agree with you for maybe three major reasons, one of which this person told me, by the way, and if you want to get to the Akashic Records in a little while, we can talk about that, because there's a phenomenal story about that.
Sure.
That one, of course, is, and you and I know this from all the years of looking at what governments do, doesn't matter who's the president, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, irrelevant. Why would the government say something it doesn't have to say? I mean, what would motivate somebody? I mean, with all the grief that every president faces, do you think that Barack Obama is going to stand up like Martinez on the event and say, oh, by the way, we've been lying to you for 60 years, and I just want to clear the air. And can you imagine what various news pundits would say were this to happen? Now, the other theory is, oh, well, all you've got to say is that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, that extraterrestrials are real, there's life on other planets, the Vatican already accepted this, now we must too. That's like a cosmic Watergate. It is once you have this little thread unraveling from the edge of a huge tapestry, do you think that all the people who claim to have been abducted by extraterrestrials are going to sit there quietly and not demand an answer? All the pilots for 60 years that have had UFO encounters, all the landings, all the places, and we can go through all the cases like Delphos, Kansas, and Marley Woods, where there's ongoing contact.
And incredible cases.
Phenomenal cases that will blow your mind because the evidence is so stunning. Do you think they're going to keep quiet about this? So, of course, the government is not going to review it. So those are two. And then the other thing is, I think that disclosure has already happened. I mean, if you look at some of these cases, you don't need the president of the United States to tell you what's true. That was, again, the point of this book, Aliens in America. So many people in high places have revealed the truth that you don't need a formal press announcement in front of all the media to tell you this is true. We know that disclosure has happened. It happened all the way back. And Stanton said this, and it was one of the smartest things Stanton ever said, quite frankly, when I first met him. He said that disclosure already took place in 1947 at Roswell when it made the headlines.
He might be right. He might be right. But, you know, David Wilcock thinks that the president's going to be flanked by ETs. That'll never happen.
Never, never, ever. First of all, private theory, call me crazy. They called me crazy when they said this person, Terrell Copeland, was a hybrid. But the president's already flanked by ETs. I mean, part of what I really think is that aliens just didn't show up in 1947. It wasn't as though, oh, look, these people are playing with an atomic bomb. Let's go down. Maybe one species did. But if you look at, I mean, you and I are both guest experts, hosts on Ancient Aliens. And the point is that I think that Earth has been populated, invaded, so to speak, infested by various forms of alien intelligence and alien beings for literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And I think that, yeah, there are people working in the government who really either are hybrid aliens or are aliens themselves, and they've been manipulating the human race ever since we crawled out of the muck. And when I asked one of our guests on UFO Hunters about this, and you know, it's a guy who said, oh, never use my name, but everybody knows who he is. He said, yes, He knows various people who claim to be extraterrestrial. And of course, there's the Yingo Swan book about meeting an extraterrestrial in Los Angeles. And he said that they've been with us and certain people know about them. And so I said, look, you know the trilogy Foundation and Empire that Isaac Asimov wrote all the way back in the 1950s? Was Isaac Asimov in the know? And he said, absolutely. I said, so is Foundation and Empire not science fiction? He goes, no, it's real history. And yeah, there are groups manipulating our history on planet Earth, call it psychohistory. That was Asimov's term. And they've been manipulating us for literally hundreds of thousands of years.
Good point, Bill. Yeah, absolutely. Tell me more about the Hudson Valley sightings.
The Hudson Valley sightings are exciting because and this, again, one of the reasons it fits into the paradigm of the cases that I chose is that for all the explanations, I mean, this happened all the way back in the end of the 1980s and over Hudson Valley, New York, which is up around Westchester County and north. There were all these people on different both sides of the Hudson River in Connecticut who were seeing these strange triangular sets of lights in the sky. And if it was only the lights, you could say, well, you know, it's lights in the sky, could be anything, could be planes. You know, they just know what they were seeing. And then afterwards, the lights obviously fit the same pattern as the Phoenix lights. They moved very slowly. They were noiseless. They seemed to move against the prevailing winds, so they weren't just balloons in the sky. And there was a group called the Stormville Flyers who said, oh, we were the ones that did this. We had low-flying planes. We were flying very slowly in a very tight formation. And the pilots who were on the ground witnessing the lights said, no way, these are planes. I mean, first of all, the Stormville Flyers are not going to fly planes that make no sounds. If they're that low and they're moving that slowly, their engines are going to be whining so loud that you'll hear the roar of the engines from these small planes. Small planes are loud. If you live in the vicinity of any small airport, Santa Monica Airport, for example, you will hear these small planes screaming as they try to gain altitude. So the noise factor eliminates that. But then, and here's where Vicki Ecker from UFO Magazine covered the story, she interviewed the person at Indian Point Nuclear Facility.
Pick it up right from there, Bill, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Bill Burns, author of Aliens in America. We'll be right back.